Online Radio Network, restoring vitality to you and to the planet. I'm your co-host, Scott Patton, and joining us, as usual, is the founder of the Life Enthusiast Co-op, Martin Patella. Hey, Martin, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you. Doing great.
Awesome. We got a special show for everybody. Joining us today is an amazing gentleman with over 16 years of dedicated experience and understanding of the inner workings of the human body. He's a true living master of what it means to walk the talk on the road to higher and higher levels of natural beauty, vibrant health, and peak performance. And I had the honor and delight of being with him on two occasions in the last 6 months, because he swung through here twice, once doing an evening talk on superfood smoothies, which was absolutely amazing, and then certifying my girlfriend the next day as a certified super smoothie expert. And then he came and spoke at the Seed event a couple months later, which I volunteered at and helped out at. And in both cases, I just found it absolutely amazing and just a fountain of information. So we want to welcome to the show David Wolf. Hey, David, how you doing?
Awesome. How you guys doing?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're in sunny Hawaii.
That's right. Yeah, it's great here. We're in sunny Hawaii and just been soaking up the mana. You know, as they say here, this place has mana. It's got something in the soil and the air and the water that is different, that you really can substantially feel it. And it's just incredible. The rejuvenation you can pick up here in a very short period of time is pretty extraordinary.
Which island are you on?
I'm on Kauai.
Oh, cool.
And I just got over here from Big Island. So I spent quite a bit of time over on Big Island on this particular trip, and then jumped over here to Kauai. It's quite phenomenal on both these islands. One of them is the oldest, Kauai, of the chain, and then the newest is the Big Island. So we were on, you know, we kind of danced between those.
Awesome. We have been talking on our podcasts with our audience about Ormus and the, you call it mana. It's another nice name for it. It's my theory that I put forward that this comes from well down below the Earth, perhaps the Earth's core, and it comes up on volcanic emissions. And it's found in so many locations on the planet, and I believe it's the volcanic soils that carry that extra kick, that extra nutrient, which wakes up or supports the life force in all of us, in all living things.
So that's definitely what you definitely feel that when you're on the lava. And I was actually dangerously on the lava a few days ago, where literally the molten lava was 5 inches below my feet. It was melting the rubber on my shoes.
Wow.
On my vibrant five fingers. And I was with my friend Elijah, and we were like, uh-oh, we better get going. Because we walked right to where the lava was flowing into the ocean, and then we kind of backtracked up the flow a little bit where it was a little bit cooler, because it was an underground lava flow, basically. Oh. And we walked over, and we were in between lava flows before too long. And then on the way back, we took a different way back, and we hit a hot spot, and it was really hot, and you could look between the cracks and see the lava. Literally, it was 5 inches below your feet. It was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, that must be an impressive and almost life-changing experience, how you, when you connect to the core of the planet this close, right?
It is really special. I think that's one of the great things about the Big Island of Hawaii. There's probably only two places in the world where you can get an experience like that, and one of them is Hawaii, the other is Iceland.
Right.
And it's what you're saying. I mean, the coconuts that come from that lava field and the noni that comes from that lava field, it has the mana in it. It's got the magic. Something's going on there that's very unique. And also the honey that comes off the ohia trees that grows on that lava field it's got it. You could smell the DMT on it. I mean, you could smell the honey itself. Smells and tastes like DMT.
So you're actually closer to God every time you ingest that food, because it just wakes up that extra neurotransmitter connection, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, so something like that's going on.
Yeah, you probably don't know it about the Life Enthusiast movement, but ever since I started this company, we have been promoting Ormus and Ormus products, and been with the alchemists, and I you know, I'm one of the people who has been teaching others how to concentrate their armas out of sea salts. And anyway,
we're on a very parallel track. I mean, from my interactions with you, we're on a very parallel track. I mean, it's just amazing, actually.
Yes.
Very similar approach to diet, nutrition, lifestyle, health in general, Ormus elements. I mean, you appear to be extremely versed in this area, adaptogens, for a long period of time. I find that to be really cool. We're actually very, very closely aligned.
Well, very much so. Very much so. The big advantage you have is that you have gone on the stage and you have, I don't know if you ever had the fear of public exposure and being out there, but you've done a phenomenal job of being the voice, being out there, pushing it. I guess
we really appreciate that too, David, because you know, someone has to get out there and kind of whack at the bushes and get people back on the right track, because we've just
seemed to be the vanguard. Yeah.
We just seem to have gone so far off track with plastic foods.
It literally is plastic food. I mean, it's like that. I find it cool that you guys are like, you have the whole perspective and you've kind of arrived at a similar conclusion. I mean, that's kind of what we're really aligned on, is that through all your research, you've arrived at the same kind of conclusions that I have. And that's very cooperating. It's kind of strengthens our resolve, doesn't it? Makes me feel like, okay, I'm not just out to lunch. This makes sense, and we're on track.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would echo that. We're crazy, but we're crazy together, and it turns out that crazy is the only way that the knowledge of humanity gets advanced. I'm reminded of that famous statement that says, all discoveries are at first violently opposed.
Right.
Then they're ridiculed and finally accepted as self-evident.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Blaise Pascal's phrase, which is, the old ideas are never overturned. The people who have them simply just die off.
Okay.
That's how I look at it.
Okay. Well, so here we are. We have been doing what you have been doing, just not as effectively. I totally admire you for what you've done, and the movement you have kicked off, and all the wonderful content that's out there with your name on it or your voice. So it's great.
Well, and I found it was really exciting the two times that I listened to you to go, wow, like, here's somebody else saying exactly the things that I've been hearing for years and years and years from Martin. And I felt the same way, I think, that you did, David, and that, wow, like, we're not really alone. Like, we felt like, you know, solitary voices in the wilderness, and here I am with 200 people crammed into this room, all listening to you talk, and going, all right, you know, it's kind of nice to be part of that community.
Right on, yay, absolutely, and we are the part of the same community. So I guess for everybody listening, we should probably get into some of the conclusions that we've arrived at. You know, kind of focus that. Like, I'd like to hear from you guys. Like, what? Where have you, like, where do you land on the whole, like, vegetarian, vegan, raw food, omnivore, carnivore story?
Fantastic question you put forward. In the last year, I have become a certified metabolic typing advisor. Metabolic typing is a fairly young branch of science, but it's able to explain why some people are completely happy on eating vegetarian, no meat food, and others, like, I remember you and Daniel Vitalis on stage ribbing one another, you making total fun of him that he just has to go and start eating high protein and high fat meals, because there's just no way he can be a carbo dominant eater.
Right. Yeah.
And so when you say, where do you fall on this? My statement is, raw is good because it's rich in enzymes. And biodynamically grown is good because it actually has the minerals and nutrients and all of the primal bits of nutrition that are supposed to be there. So it's not good enough to just eat raw. You need to focus on raw organic and organic biodynamic. which cool. then right. brings us back to the ormus and the volcanic soil and the rock dusting of the fields and all of that form of make sure that the nutrients you eat, and I believe that it's the pigments, it's the greens, the reds, the yellows, the oranges, all of the pigmentation that your body needs a lot of in order to stay protected and not succumb to the metabolic fires. I see it as you're burning up something in order to create energy in presence of oxygen, but that's sort of like holding a glowing ember in your hand. Each cell is producing this metabolic fire and needs to somehow contain it, and I believe that the container are these antioxidants, all of these nutrients that we need to eat. And to complete on that, that picture is some people have become, probably through ancestors, I think it's genetically motivated, perhaps the 10,000 generations of the ancestors have become adapted to a life on a certain terrain, like for instance on a seashore as fishermen or in the middle of a forest somewhere tropical where it was easy to find fruit every day, or somewhere in a cold northern forest where hunting was the only available option in the winter. And so with that, some people have adapted in a way that requires high protein and high fat in their diet and low carb. And others go sort of the middle of the road where they are fish and eggs and vegetables, but not a lot of carbs. And then the third one would be the vegan vegetarian tropical eater, which finds it very easy to eat very low protein diet and be quite balanced and happy.
Yeah, right on. I mean, I feel like we're a humanoid, and that humanoid form has the ability to adapt better than probably any other form on the planet, and that's what makes us really special and unique. And I think that this research that David Wilcox putting out there and a number of other researchers in the kind of the alien abduction world and just all this exotic information is indicating that we're not the only humanoids in this galaxy, that there are other, that the humanoid form is like a galactic template, and that template is a pure adaptogenic template. That's how I read it, and that that wherever you're positioned, on whatever planet you're positioned, you have the greatest chance of survival with that humanoid template because you can adapt to the different environment that's there. And so I'm just kind of bringing it to the exotic and the esoteric and, you know, that level, because that's what I've been exposed to, and I just can't ignore some of the research that's been put in front of me.
Well, I'm so impressed that you're willing to step right into this one and declare it that, by the way, the humanoid is not really local to this planet. It's a result of genetic modifications, and we're really quite new. We only have maybe 250,000 years of existence, not more than that.
Right, yes, and there's a lot of research that indicates that. And then, you know, then you've got very interesting stuff. Like, I photograph as a hobby when I travel around South America. I photograph the Atlantean skulls, the skulls with the, you know, like the Akhenaten skulls, the Nefertiti skulls, the elongated skulls that were found in Egypt. They've been found all over South America. They've recently found them in Mexico. And, you know, they tell you, oh, this is just the Paleolithic equivalent of braces. They would deform their skull on purpose. But then when you look at those skulls, you see that they have different teeth, they have a different jaw, they have different jaw bones, they have different places where the muscles connect to their skull. It's a completely different skull. Now, if that was a Neanderthal skull, it would be all over the news. It'd be the big, look, we found a Neanderthal skull. But when it's an Atlantean skull, it's completely hushed up and nobody even wants to talk about it, let alone the other types of skulls that have been found, including the giant skulls with the double sets of teeth, of which there has been dozens found in North America. So this is a very interesting time because we're breaking up the centralized control of our history of where we came from. We're starting to look at maybe other alternatives and also alternative evidence. And again, that humanoid form, though, does predominate. And that humanoid form is a pure adaptogenic form. So that leads us right into adaptogens. So maybe you guys, I think I'd like to hear your take on adaptogens and what your feelings about those kinds of foods and herbs.
Oh, I don't have a take on that. I don't know. You're way ahead of me on that. I mean, certainly I recognize it as a ways of dealing with the glandular dominance. Just to say what I understand, there's been some research done on body typing and glandular dominance. There being body types dominated either by thyroid, adrenals, pituitary, or the gonads, and each one of them creates a specific physical type. Like, for instance, you would be the thyroid dominant, your body design. Somebody like a linebacker in a football team, that's a classic adrenal. And anyway, to say that there are food preferences and there are physical characteristics that go with each one of those types. And it has a profound effect on how we evolve and how we should behave in order to stay healthy.
Fascinating. Now, what about this research on the great super tonic herbs and their adaptogenic capabilities? How far do you go into the metabolic typing with herbalism? I mean, how far does it go? I mean, I can understand it would go into carbohydrate, protein, and fat.
Right. Well, you know, the metabolic typing focuses primarily on the calories, on how they are acquired. And you have... to give an analogy, you have two types of engines in automobiles, the gas engine and the diesel engine. And the diesel engine requires thicker fluid that doesn't burn so easy. The gasoline engine requires a lighter fluid that burns easy. And if you swap it, if you put diesel into the gas engine, you gum it up. If you put gasoline into the diesel engine, you essentially burn it out. In humans, you have some that have a very efficient conversion of carbohydrates into energy, too efficient, and they would be called fast oxidizer, and they need to eat high fat, high protein, because that's not so easy to convert into energy. If you give them too much carb, too much sugar, they just go through this swing of being fairly manic for a short time, which is followed by a crash. And the other way around is, of course, if you have somebody whose metabolism is not very efficient, you need to feed them the lighter fluid, which fuel, I should say, which is the more carbohydrates in their diet.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And that appears to be the basic predominating metabolic types, those two, basically.
Well, yeah, essentially the two groups, one or the other. But it's like a rainbow, or it's like a infinite spectrum. On one end, you will have somebody that's more almost an Eskimo, living on whale blubber and seal meat, and on the other hand, you will have some desert oasis dweller who'll be on figs, dates, and pomegranates,
and both thriving, which is the amazing thing, right?
Yeah. Right. That is amazing.
And then if you switch the diets, then they're both sick, or
you will make them sick. And David, here's the interesting thing. Depending on which type you are, you will either become overly acidic or overly alkaline by the foods that you do or don't get. And so if, for instance, you are sympathetic like myself, I start my day overly acidic and I alkalize with carbs. So if I don't eat carbs, I become increasingly crabby and miserable.
And you don't want to be around him when he's crabby and miserable.
So I need to remember to make myself a great smoothie early in the day, because that's what's going to put me into my optimal state. But Scott, for instance, is completely the opposite type. He starts his day overly alkaline, and he's actually acidified, which means brought back to center, with high protein foods. So for him, the right breakfast is 2 eggs and a piece of steak, which sounds almost crazy to a raw foodist convinced, I don't know what you'd call them, you know, like people who are in that raw food movement. But you've had that experience with Daniel Vitalis, right?
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, he just represents the other side of the equation, which is important. And that's why I like putting him out there, is because, you know, you got to have the complete perspective. You got to have all sides of the metabolic types of humanity, and that's really more closer to reality and truth instead of like idealism.
What I found is out there nutritionists tend to believe that everybody is like themselves. And so they'll put out this thought that, you know, Dean Ornish put out that the low-fat, high-carb diet is the only way to go. And then the government signed on, piled on, and everybody was told to eat low-fat diet. Well, that's made many people very miserable. And then on the other extreme, you have the Atkins group, or Jorge Cruz is in there. They are telling people no carbs, just proteins and fats. And it works for those for whom it's appropriate, but
right,
not for everybody.
Exactly. Not for everybody. And so the one-size-fits-all is the core understanding that we're overturning. I mean, there's no more one-size-fits-all anything. We're too adaptable. We're too different. The ecosystems are too diverse for that to occur.
Right. Yeah. But the thing that does work is the middle. Everybody needs a decent smoothie with all the adaptogenic herbs and medicinal mushrooms and the green things and the red things and purple things, all of that middle, everybody needs.
That's interesting. That's basically the approach that I've come to as well. And
yeah,
so
well,
let's
absolutely.
Talk about that. Like, yeah, so the medicinal mushrooms and the mushrooms in general, I mean, the way I understand it, you know, I recently wrote a book on chaga, which
yes.
I finally got that whole theory in there that mushrooms are from outer space.
Uh-huh. The spores came from out there?
Yeah, the spores came from outer space, and the spores are very electron dense. They're electron dense like a metal. I actually looked that research up. That is real, and it's true. They can survive the vacuum of space. That's also real and true. And that there's been mushroom spores coming into the planet and coming into our atmosphere and coming into the clouds and showing up in rain all along. It's innumerable, the amounts of accounts of people. Like, I remember reading one account of a guy in Arkansas who'd been living in his place for 30 years. One day there was this weird red rain, and these weird mushrooms came up in his yard he'd never seen before, and he swore they came from the rain. There are numerous accounts of that all over the place. That mushroom spores actually come in from the atmosphere, and they probably come in from the heavens, and it's been ongoing. So the way I understand it is that the medicinal mushrooms are allies of life, that they help foster ecosystems and develop ecosystems, and eventually developing tree ecosystems, which is a concentrate of an ennobled substrate, which is a levitational piece of wood. Right, a wood is coming up out of the earth, and literally it's doing everything that can't be done, which is it's elevating itself and the water within it against gravity day after day after day, all day long. And that's a more ennobled substrate with which to produce a levitational spore eventually as the force gets going and that tree begins to break down, or even some of these mushrooms live in a living tree, and they use that levitational substrate to create the levitational spore, which can eventually then rise up in the atmosphere through winds and Coriolis forces, some of which escape the atmosphere, fall into the sun, and some are slingshotted out to other worlds.
Yeah, good. I just admire the language you're able to heap into a single sentence.
right on.
But here's
what
I
get. Past Pluto right now. I'm stuck on a spore on my way past Pluto. That was great.
But here's what I would like to use to perhaps confirm and highlight, and I believe that it's the armus that the mushroom is pulling out of the decaying organic matter. Mushroom is a decomposer. It is the one thing that helps to turn dying or no longer needed tissue back into its basic components. And I believe that somehow it pulls the armus together, and you probably know that armus levitates. It only has, it exists in other dimensions. Like, it oftentimes is just two dimensions here and the one other dimension elsewhere, meaning that it has gigantic surface but no mass. And so with that, it can actually levitate exactly as you're describing, because in this 3D, 4D universe as we live in, it's actually able to become weightless or anti-grav.
I completely agree with that. That's exactly what my experience has taught me that. Mm-hmm. I've had some very interesting experiences with Ormus over the years. You know, very bizarre things have occurred, and one of them is definitely this levitational quality. and this levity that the Ormus contains. And I think you're right. I think that's what the mushrooms are going after. In fact, I've grown mushrooms with Ormus elements to see if there's a connection. And what the results of that are is that basically my experience is that when you grow mushrooms in a material that is high in Ormus elements or spray the mushrooms or mist them with Ormus elements, that they are basically become genetically perfect. They look genetically perfect. Their genotype is completely expressed in their phenotype, to put it in a scientific
So way. What you're saying is that the individual specimens are just perfectly formed?
Yes, and you can see a level of perfection the way that they grow, and just their overall, just if you take a picture of it, you're just like, this is, you know, I mean, I show pictures of these to people in the audiences, not telling them how it's growing, just like, this is how you grow mushrooms in an artificial environment, and they just are completely aghast. It looks like a castle in some kind of a fantasy land. I mean, that's what these things start looking like.
Yeah,
but they don't know the other side of the story, that they're grown in a special way.
Yeah, you're introducing the fractal existence, or the Fibonacci series of expression of life, right? How it cascades itself into these. Yeah, you're describing the castle, right? Like when you have these mushrooms that actually grow in groups, they will have these harmonious formations. It reminds me of flocks of birds traveling together, turning in a single instant. The mushroom expresses itself in a way that's somehow similar to that it's all perfect all at once.
Right. Now, that was an interesting analogy, how birds just move all at once like one organism.
Yeah. Whew. Okay. So Ormus. I believe
well,
I
before
will
you, before
Ormus
you move off
that.
The mushrooms, I have to ask you, David, how did they taste?
It's completely different. It's a completely different thing. This is my experience, and I think this is true. Basically, what I found out is that if you don't have enough Ormus in your medicinal mushrooms, you have a high triterpene content, which means you're going to have more bitter flavors. When you have more Ormus in the mushrooms, you have more higher polysaccharide content, which is basically more neutral or even slightly oily or buttery flavors. And that's very detectable to anybody's palate, actually. And that's been my conclusion about it. I think the Ormus actually adds a higher fraction of the polysaccharides. David Hudson was the first one to indicate years ago, I mean, this is back 17 years ago, that aloe vera was the polysaccharides in the aloe vera were actually the carrier of the Ormus elements. I've definitely confirmed that that's true amongst a large variety of different plants, including mushrooms. That the polysaccharide is actually the carrier of it, of the high spin element or the strange matter.
Mm-hmm. George Merkel did some research. He called it the life crystals and the Sumerian elixir and all of that. And he also found that he called it the sun or the light. I'm trying to remember the words, but to translate it how I remember it, it has to do with taking photons and slowing them down until they're static, until they're no longer moving. And it's the stored photons inside of plants that turned into these sugars or polysaccharides, as you said.
Yeah, so I remember George Merkel. I went out and saw his operation out there in El Paso, Texas once.
Wow, okay. I drank a lot of his stuff long ago.
Do you know Ray de Blasi?
No, I don't know.
Apparently, he still distributes some of Merkel's stuff. He's in. Okay. If I recall correctly, he's in BC.
It would be Osoyoos. That's where Merkel was last. Yeah.
Okay, so it's out there.
I don't know. I lost track. It's moving into the Ormus. Whenever we put Ormus on gardens, we grow more perfect fruit, strawberries, beans, whatever, carrots. Barry Carter's growing these fantastic walnuts that are the size of oranges, and oranges that are the size of softballs, and grapefruits that are the size of, I don't know what, volleyballs, gigantic things.
Yeah.
So all of this happens under the influence of the Ormus. So your statement about the perfection of the plant as it evolves under the influence of the Ormus totally makes sense. I've had just a different sidebar. We also sell something called the Prills, which is a
Prill beads?
Yeah, we're the original outlet where it all started. Not that I'm the inventor. It came with Jim Carter, who passed it on to us, and so we were at the beginnings of it back in the late 90s. And anyway, so the Prills, they change the water. They change the water in a argon energy style. They change multiple properties of it, the surface tension and the ORP and the pH and whatnot. But what happens is when you water your plants with the Prill water, they grow more perfect fruit, like tomatoes that, you know, if your biggest tomato you ever grew was 1.5 pounds, you start watering your plants and you'll be growing 2 and 3 pound tomatoes.
Awesome. So do you think, how much of that is due to the change in the surface tension of the water? Have you done that kind of research on the Prill beads?
No, we just don't have the funding to do that. But I agree that it's probably much to do with that, because it will help the plant to draw more nutrients out of the soil just because of the surface tension.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be that, go on.
I was just going to say, I mean, essentially, you know, what we're driving at and where this is going is this idea, and I kind of want to clarify this for our listeners here, is that basically this is the idea that we're driving at, is you take the most powerful plants in the world and you grow them in the most powerful way possible, and then the animals that they eat thereof, including us, will be perfected by that particular strategy, is kind of what we're driving at. Isn't that true?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually believe that the armus is the interface between the spiritual and physical worlds. I believe that the thought that exists in a non-material way, in order to express itself, needs to translate through something, and I believe that the something is the armus.
Well, yeah, that's what the research indicates. And again, just for our listeners, the armus elements are mineral materials. They're actually atoms that are like a chair with four legs, but one of those legs is sitting in another dimension. So they're not completely here. They're kind of
great analogy. That's a great analogy.
And because they are...
Well, yeah, I just wanted to mention to you guys, because this is research I've done that you may not be aware of, is that you know, we produce ormus gold out of gold, so we push it back into its ormus form. And if you send that material into a laboratory, they'll tell you it's aluminum silicate, when actually it's gold silicate. It's an ormus gold silicate. So there is definitely, for sure, I know 1,000%, a major mistake in the spectroscopic signature analysis of minerals, and that is what we're told is aluminum is sometimes actually ormus gold.
Hmm. Right. What was interesting, I was working with another fellow in this area doing a lot of analyses, and it turns out that you will have different carbonates, calcium carbonate, magnesium carbonate, phosphates and whatnot, showing up in the analysis depending on which of the armus materials you'll have more of. Like more gold will give you a certain slant, more rhodium or iridium will push it in different directions. So it will appear as different forms of chalk or dolomite or that sort of thing, depending on what the starting metallic version of that mix was.
That's such an important point for new people, because people will go, well, how come we haven't figured this out? Well, we basically have a very big problem with our spectroscopic signature analysis standards. Like, there's only standards for the named minerals, but the unnamed minerals don't have standards, like ormus rhodium, ormus iridium, ormus osmium, ormus gold, ormus silver, don't have standards, so they're being misidentified as something else.
Right.
That's kind of the idea. So when we get back to this, like the green powders, the superfoods, the super herbs, what are your guys' favorites? What do you really like? I mean, I can definitely give you a list of my favorites, but I'd like to hear what you guys are really into.
Well, I haven't been needing to rely on individual ingredients thanks to my long-term relationship with Exula and Javari Oberon, who's been doing the mixing and blending. So we have the simple and the more complex and the really complex, and I don't really have to try and name each one of them. I mean, you're the genius in that. But so is he. Thank you very much. But so the basics. biodynamically grown in an enormous rich soil. And then we start with grasses like kamut grass, barley, then other greens like chlorella, spirulina, and then the important ones like schizandra, acerola, ashwagandha, amla, tulsi. Those are really, really important ones because they are tweaking the body's metabolic processes, all the exchanges, the energetics. But just to go to the basics, every heartbeat, for every muscle contraction, calcium has to be involved. For every muscle lengthening, relaxation, magnesium has to be involved. So each swing to the sympathetic side requires calcium. Each swing to the parasympathetic side requires magnesium. This is ebb and flow, inhale, exhale, yin yang. It's always involved in this dance, and the pulsation could be very quick, microscopic, milliseconds, or it could be longer, like your breath, inhale, exhale, or maybe lifetime, like being born, living, dying. You know, these rhythms, there are different time scales, but it's all there, and it's all fractal life expression like that.
Right, and I think the other thing that's really important, and this to me is a key, and Martin talks about it all the time, but he missed it, so I'm going to jump in and say it. It's not destroyed food in terms of being heated so everything gets burnt or what we call cooked, right? So creating all of the mixtures in a way that keeps the values that are there in nature is really important.
Yeah, you said it well.
That's a fundamental premise. That's a very important premise as well, is that we've got to have that connection to what's the way nature produces it, mm-hmm. instead of trying to change it, cook it, microwave it, change, you know, obviously chemically alter it in some ways. You know, we're very deep into playing around like that, which is a little bit beyond, I think, our capabilities at this point in our evolution and our understanding. We just haphazardly just fry everything. So going with the way nature presents it seems to be a really good starting place.
And I think, David, the other problem that we run into, and I'm seeing this as I'm looking at kind of the McDonald's, what they do sort of thing, right, is we think this molecule is what does it. So we extract that single molecule and we leave every, you know, 99.9999% of the rest of it, you know, wherever else, and we take that molecule, we reproduce the molecule, and we stick it into something, and we say, eat this, it's going to fix you. And we don't know. And I think that's the other part of the problem with you. We called it plastic food, and the other part of it is saying, well, it's this particular extract, or it's this particular molecule, and it may or may not be, we don't know.
Yeah, you're highlighting two important things, Scott. One of them is the reductionism or reductionist thinking, which is, of course, behind all the technological and pharmaceutical and modern industrial food processing, because everybody in that business is trying to create a unique, patentable object.
Yeah.
And they cannot patent nature. And the other one is the concept of enzymes, which represent the difference between living and not living. When the enzymes are present, the food, the protein can be either food or is still part of a living creature. Once the enzymes are gone, it's no longer reproducing. It's just to give an example, on a label, a bag of fresh almonds and bag of roasted almonds will appear to have the same ingredients. And a typical North American label, as we know it, cannot show any difference whatsoever. And yet, the fresh almonds will sprout and will grow new almond trees. And the other one is just dead stuff that won't decompose even because it's made so dead.
But let me ask you guys about the next thing, which is just enzyme supplements in general. So how do you feel about enzyme supplements in general?
If a person eats cooked food, it's a necessity. if you're eating raw, biodynamic right off your garden, which is so luxurious, you know, there are so few people on the planet that can eat like that these days, then you wouldn't need it.
Raw food is so incredible. But I found last summer, not this 2012, but the summer before 2011, I broke my foot in a volleyball accident, and I obviously didn't go to doctors or anything, didn't get anything done. I just, you know, got it set correctly and then just tightened it down. And what was interesting is I had access to everything, including access to nothing, including fasting. And I found that enzymes, I just kind of suddenly just, my instinct told me enzymes. So I started taking 30 enzymes a day, and man, it took the swelling right out immediately. Hmm. I mean, it was profound. And then I started taking a ton more, you know, over a period of a week, and all of a sudden it just started healing, like, really fast. And it was such a profound change that I actually went back and I reread the old books on enzymes, and I was like, whoa, it is a known thing that enzymes increase the speed of your healing by a factor of 2 or 3 times.
There's a few people that we deal with enzymes that basically say if you want to get young, take a ton of them. Like Generation Plus.
I was going to say, just as you started speaking, Scott, I was going to say the theory of aging. We know that older people have fewer enzyme or lower enzyme levels. And then can we say that enzymes decline as we age, or should we state that when your enzymes decline, you become older?
My research on that is interesting. I think there's two very important enzymes that don't get mentioned a whole lot, which are trypsin and chymotrypsin, which are two very powerful rejuvenating enzymes. Are you familiar with those enzymes?
Familiar, yes, but not that I could just start stating theories. We have worked primarily with the digestive, you know, the amylase, protease, that sort of stuff in the digestive, and then we have done a lot of work with the fibrinolytics for people who have been injured or have inflammation in their body, like the serrapeptase, natokinase, that sort of thing. I'm well aware of the trypsin, chymotrypsin, especially as it relates to the pancreatic enzymes. We have been sort of reluctant to go there because it involves harvesting it from the pancreas of animals. Most of it is available through dead pigs' pancreas, desiccated and all that. And, you know, my own personal belief that pig is not a good animal to eat. And so I'm having some, what shall we call it, issues with the consciousness of that. But I believe that it's really important.
I feel like this whole thing about, you know, when you go into an enzyme bankruptcy, which is, you know, you're 65, all of a sudden you can't digest anything, your enzymes are depleted, it really has to do with your metabolic enzymes, trypsin and chymotrypsin. That those two, when they get depleted, that's when you get into real trouble. That's my feeling about it, from the, you know, kind of cross-referencing the research. But I've never seen anything that really just said that on point. I do believe that some enzyme researchers, people who formulate enzymes, are aware of this, but it's not overtly out there. So I kind of wanted to just mention that, put that out there. Mm-hmm. I really think that's where the trouble starts, is when you get into a deficiency of trypsin or chymotrypsin, then you're in trouble.
Okay, I'm going to put it out there, and I'll get back to you. I have two guys that we work with. One of them is William Wong, and he's heavily into the pancreatic enzymes. And the other one, the boss at Generation Plus, which, you know, I'm going to talk to him too, and to see what he'll come up with.
Cool. Now, William Wong had this whole thing that came out years ago about flax being estrogenic. I just did an enormous amount of research on phytoestrogens in food and how they affect different types of cancers and uh-huh. what's been learned, and it's a blossoming area of research for sure. But I think he's right. I think that flax is estrogenic in a way that's not good when eaten excessively. What do you guys think?
Let me say it this way. All seeds, all nuts, all grains, and all legumes have this enzymatic protection on them that blocks them from sprouting too soon. And as long as you eat them unsprouted, you expose yourself to this enzyme, to this estrogenic, phytoestrogenic effect.
And so what you're saying, Martin, is the reason that a nut or a seed can lay in the field for decades or hundreds of years, and then all of a sudden the conditions become good for it to grow, is because of this covering that they have and these enzymes and I can't even say those words. So if you eat it in that condition, why would you be surprised that those don't work on your body the same way, shutting things
down? Let me cite an interesting study. When a male mouse eats a lot of grain, he is becoming less interested in sex and reproduction because his estrogen levels are going up. And that's because the phytoestrogen in the whole grain is essentially turning him into a girl. And this also happens to a lot of men who eat a lot of whole grain food, whether it's whole grain bread or whether it's whole flax or whole nuts. Until they're sprouted, they have this phytoestrogenic effect. And this is a real issue with soy, or soy milk, rice milk, almond milk. If it's made from non-sprouted, non-soaked product, it's trouble. So that's where I stand on that, David.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I mean, all of the research is indicating that these seeds do have estrogenic effects. Seeds, nuts, legumes, and grains have estrogenic effects. The question then comes in, okay, are the phytoestrogen effects good, bad, or ugly? I mean, where do they fit? And for the most part, it's ugly. For the most part, is what I can from what I can see.
Well, estrogen dominance is never good for postmenopausal women, right? And even young ones with estrogenic dominance are not doing so well. They need to be able to swing between the estrogen and progesterone. If they stay estrogen high, it's always creating all manner of PMS-y type of problems. So I would say all people should be eating grains only when they're soaked or sprouted. And that's grains, nuts, seeds, and legumes, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. I mean, I definitely feel there's stronger evidence of that based on this aspect, on the hormonal research. Okay, so where do you guys stand on bioidentical hormones? I mean, we're seeing a lot more interest in that. There's a lot more talk about it, for sure, in the media, all along the media. Where do you guys stand on bioidentical hormones? What do you think's good, bad? Where are we at on that one?
Well, bioidentical by itself means that it should be identical. So if it's truly identical without some fudging, then it's okay. Now the question, of course, is, are we supposed to live forever? Are we supposed to reproduce until we're 97? I mean, in nature, if you look at a gorilla or a chimpanzee or something like that, they have a life, they live, and at some point they do stop reproducing. So when we are getting older, is it natural that we're supposed to get into the harvest side of our lives? Or are we supposed to stay in the summer forever? I don't know. I guess we're all inclined to give ourselves an extension on our active years.
Yeah, it's kind of human nature. If we can have it, I think a lot of people are going to choose it.
Absolutely.
My 87-year-old mother, she says, "Well, I'm getting close to the end, and you do need to make room for the young ones. I mean, we cannot live forever. There would be no room left."
It's a good point. I mean, this is a very interesting issue. It's like, okay, we're going to develop the technology to live longer. We already have. There's going to be more coming down the pipeline. Is it the right thing? Should we live longer? And I kind of feel like we should, actually, myself, because the longer you're on the planet, the more that you're in that state of immortality, the less likely you're going to damage the planet because the longer you're here.
Well, yeah, that's a great thought. And also, if you knew that your time horizon wasn't 20, but it was 900, you will have a very different relationship with your surroundings and with the whole fabric, the environment, the everything. Like you become one with nature because you can no longer afford to be an exploiter. There's another word for it, a plunderer of the resources.
Yeah, well said. Very well said. Yeah, and there's a great phrase that I picked up out of raw food literature years ago, and this is the phrase, immortality is the only cause worth dying for.
That's a good one.
That one stuck with me.
That's a lovely line. Lovely, lovely. And so I would say yes, we should. We should all think in longer horizons. We all should extend our time where we're still able to contribute. I mean, I'm so resentful of the society as we have it right now, where we have these old people who are warehoused in these institutions where they are destined to first play golf and then play cribbage and canasta and then just simply drool and die.
Yeah, it's grossly inefficient. It's inappropriate, and it's you've got to keep working until your final day. That's really what I feel is appropriate. And if you do what you love, then you can keep working, and you got to continue to contribute in order to feel like you want to live on.
Indeed. So if you can find a way to extend my productive years, I'm all for it. If you're going to extend my existence, miserable and useless, forget it.
Yeah, forget it. Absolutely. Well, you guys are life enthusiasts, so I think you fall on the former. You want to extend that ability to contribute and really to also be just an active part of a community.
Okay, so I wanted to swing it back in and say, well, you've done such a fantastic job with the longevity conference, and you know, I wanted to be sure that we get to mention it to our listeners and that we get to tell them where they can number one attend if they can do it in person, because everybody who's ever gone comes back saying, I loved it. It was worth the time and the money and the sacrifice. But even awesome. if they can't, even just getting the recordings, and you probably still make available previous year's recordings or future, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in many cases we do deals where, you know, we're giving away 30 DVDs for like $120 or $130. I mean, really, really good deals like that of past conferences. And the conference itself is a really incredible kinesthetic experience, just being with all those people in that environment. We've got the hotel set up in our favor. It's been very, very, very difficult and taken many, many years to find a hotel that will actually work with us in the way that we want to be worked with. For example, they only serve organic food in the hotel restaurant. I mean,
wow.
You know how hard it is to get that to happen?
I'd say that's impossible.
It's impossible. It is. Yeah. It is. I gave up years ago, but luckily I have people on my team who didn't give up, and they just kept on it. And finally, this one hotel, the Hilton Hotel in Orange County, California, in Costa Mesa, said, we'll do it. And so, and they let us do all our own food downstairs. So they have organic food in their restaurant, and then we have all our food downstairs. That's, of course, all organic. And, you know, we've got all our superfoods and everything else there. So it's an entirely organic event. We've got the run of the whole downstairs of the entire hotel, so it's just completely under our control, and we just have the best time ever. And we've got some great speakers, including Brzezinski, the guy who's figured out this whole, you know, the cancer doctor is coming.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and he's the guy who's figured out this whole thing about peptides, which are protein chains shorter than 50 proteins long. So a chain that's shorter than 50 amino acids is called a peptide, and he found out that cancer patients had very disturbed peptide in their urine. They had wrong ratios. They were missing a huge amount of peptides. And he went about to work when he was a graduate student to figure out, well, maybe I could replenish these specific peptides and see if we can normalize these patients. And he's had one of the highest success rates against cancer of any doctor in the world. It's around 80% remission mm-hmm. rate, which is incredible.
Yeah.
So he's going to talk.
Nice.
Okay. It's you know, like, I want to give him the props for doing all that. My personal belief is that I would like to spend more time in prevention than in the back end of it, where I'm needing to try and save it. and fix it. And of course, it's great because most people are motivated only after they have problems rather than before.
Right, yeah, when the pain has gotten to them. And unfortunately, we do live in a world that has to get to pain before a change is made. But right. I think what's interesting about Brzezinski and what I'm going to talk to him about at the conference, and by the way, the conference is May 2nd through 5th, 2013, at the Orange County Hilton in Orange County, California, Costa Mesa. And what I'm going to talk to him about is he's basically figured out some kind of a backup immune system. That if there's a secondary immune system, that if you have the right peptide profile in your diet, your body is able to approach and accommodate an attack on mutated cells, on carcinogens, on, you know, tumors or whatever. And that's really interesting. You know, so I don't think he's the end all. I think he's the beginning of a whole area of research that's just opening up. And I'm trying to get into it to figure out, okay, what is the preventative piece from what he's discovered? You know what I mean?
Okay, like,
his mind for that. Because, you know, he's dealing with people who are dying and we're dealing with people who are living.
You know, my own perspective on it has been using the Otto Warburg studies where he documents that when you decrease the oxygen level by 35%, the cell will switch from respiration to fermentation. And at some point it will become permanent. So
I think that's seminal work, by the way.
Seminal. And so we've been focusing on understanding how we can get the oxygen back in and how we can get the cells to switch back to respiration or to shut down. So we've been taking a different approach than what Brzezinski is doing. Not to take away from that, but I just really want to focus elsewhere.
Yeah, I get that. I kind of like to have a broad swath of the entire natural healing movement, and because you never know, maybe at one point there'll be some kind of a mega breakthrough that brings it all together. Maybe there already has been that, we just don't know about it, but I feel like that's coming. The cross-referencing of all this information is leading us somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he deserves the respect. I mean, man, this guy walked the dark path against the odds and the obstacles that he has faced. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, and he's facing some very dark forces on the planet. Chemical, petroleum, energy conglomerates that are run by banks, which is about as bad as it gets, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. All right, well.
So that sounds like it's going to be a fun 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, so we're going to make sure that we're going to tell our listeners where they can register and how. It's going to be on the podcast. And I don't know, maybe we'll see you there.
Fantastic. You guys should come down. That'd be great.
We should.
We'd love to.
It's going to be about, we hold it, we could make it bigger, but we just find it so nice to be in that hotel, so we just keep it at 1,500 people.
Nice.
So it's not too crazy. It's not like, you know, 3,000 people or 10,000 people. We just keep it in that nice zone, and we cap it at 1,500, and then that way we can kind of, you know, have the hotel in an organic format where everybody can get the food they're looking for. We can really interact, and we just found that that's a really good number. And so that's, you know, just for the folks out there who are wondering, you know, how crazy is it going to be, we keep it relatively small.
Cool. And there's another event that you've got happening before that, which is the Women's Wellness Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We've just noticed over the years, with our demographic of like who's actually interested in superfoods, who's interested in herbalism, who's interested in raw foods, who's interested in enzymes, who's interested in health, it's mostly women. It's mostly women. And it's pretty strongly swayed. It's probably about 65% to 70%. And so we thought, you know what, why don't we just start targeting an event that's just for women, that really focuses on women's health issues, because women are more sensitive to the xenoestrogens in our environment. They're more sensitive to the phytoestrogens in the food supply, like in the soy and all of that. And so we decided to do that last year. We had a very successful event, and we're doing our second one on February 15 through 17, coming up soon here, 2013, at the same location, at the Orange County Hilton in Orange County, California. This is in Costa Mesa, the city of Costa Mesa. And that's going to be a really fun event. It's great. Now, what's interesting, it's open to men and women.
I was going to ask that question.
Men assume it's not for them. So it's actually, one of my friends showed up and he's like, "You've done it." And I was like, "Did what?" He's like, "You got rid of all the guys." And I thought, yeah, I didn't even think of that until I said that. I was like, "Whoa, I actually did get rid of all the guys." Because guys think they shouldn't come because it's a women's wellness conference. There's usually only about 10 guys there, and you know, out of about 700 women.
Nice.
But whatever, you know, you guys are welcome.
Okay, so I would say that this is probably the best place for a single 45 plus year old enlightened guy to go and meet his next partner, right?
I would. That's you. You cut right to the chase. Thank you. Yes. That's where the smart money is. If you want to be smart, you're looking for the right woman who's interested in health and who's on the cutting edge and is, you know, willing to learn, expand consciousness and awareness. That's a great place to be, and you don't have any competition whatsoever.
Sold, David.
So likewise,
you're seeing me
probably
there for sure.
So likewise for the 10 guys who show up, they are probably.
Their husbands.
Frequently asked, right?
Their husbands.
They got dragged.
It was amazing, actually. It was
okay.
Really, really
cool.
Oh, that's great.
Mm. Awesome.
Awesome. Cool. So we'll let everybody know exactly where they can go to register and show up. It doesn't matter if you're a guy or a gal, you're welcome, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's very educational. And a lot of fun. And again, we serve great food, great organic food.
Yeah. The food around you is absolutely stunning. I say
Thank
that from
you.
Personal
and
experience. Delicious.
I felt like, you know, I've been so – thank you for that. And I've definitely been blessed in my life, no question about it. It amazes me the type of food that is around me and that people serve and that I've been privy to, that I've had access to. I think it is the best food in the world ever. You know, the Pharaohs never had anything like this. I mean, this is incredible.
That's right.
Okay,
well, Martin,
I think we have come to full circle.
We have, and thanks, you guys. And you guys have been great fun, and I'll hopefully see you in Vancouver, if not Calgary, or at the Women's Wellness Conference or at the Longevity Conference, or all four.
That'd
yes,
be awesome.
We'll make sure to connect and hope to have you again when you have something important we would like to share with the world. You know, there are plenty of people listening here. So when you when you discover the next thing on the longevity breakthrough or whatever it is that you have to share, let's have you over.
Okay, thanks so much. Fantastic.
Awesome. So you've been listening to the Life Enthusiast Co-op online radio network, restoring vitality to you and the planet. Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. Thank you, David Wolf, for being such a gracious guest. We really appreciate it. Hope to have you on again soon.
And reach us at 1-866-543-3388 or website www.life-enthusiast.com. Thank you so much for listening.